Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as you know, on this show, we invite you to be a listener producer and send us your topic ideas for the program. Click on You Produce when you go to WNYC.org and Brian Lehrer Show. And recently, one listener wrote in with concerns about some of the changes underway at the City Administration for Children's Services in the wake of the death of Nix Mary Brown, the Brooklyn 7-year-old killed by her stepfather, allegedly last year, despite warning signs that the city knew about. So we're going to follow up on this listener's request now and air some of those concerns about the changes that have taken place as a result of the death of Nix Mary Brown by speaking first with Elizabeth Roberts, Deputy Commissioner for Family Support Services at ACS, and a little later with Andrew White from the New School, who edits Child Welfare Watch, and from two people on the front lines of working with families at risk. First, Deputy Commissioner Roberts. Deputy Commissioner, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Can you start by filling our listeners in on the two basic functions of ACS, prevention and protection? What's the difference?
So we are responsible for ensuring the safety of all of the children in New York City. And, of course, the protective piece of that is that we investigate reports of suspected child abuse and neglect. We're responsible for determining if abuse or neglect occurred and if the family needs services in order to ensure the safety of the children and their well-being. And we can provide preventive services intended to strengthen the family. We can seek intervention from the family court, which could include court-ordered supervision. And we can, in the scenario where the child can't be kept safe in their own home, we can have that child placed in foster care with the intervention of the court.
And you primarily supervise the prevention side, correct?
That's right.
How many families are involved with the Administration for Children's Services?
So we investigated about 65,000 abuse and neglect reports in New York City last year. We currently have 30,000 children in the city receiving preventive services, and we have 17,000 children in foster care.
The listener who wrote in was specifically concerned with the changing relationship between the agency and the nonprofit organizations it contracts with. So how do those relationships work?
So we contract with about 75 preventive service providers. They run 200 programs throughout the city. Those programs are primarily neighborhood-based programs. There are a range of specialized programs, for example, programs for substance-abusing parents and their children. We oversee those providers. We contract with them. We monitor their practice with families. If we find weaknesses, we address that and put the organization on a corrective action plan. So we're we're really the funding and oversight agency for those frontline preventive services programs.
And what are some of the big changes put in place at ACS since Nix Mary Brown, and what are they trying to fix?
So there are really two areas of change. One is that we have invested substantial new resources in preventive services. We really recognize that we're referring quite a few very high-risk families to these preventive programs and that they needed additional support to be as successful as possible with those families. So we invested, we provided flexible service enhancement funds that programs could use to improve their parenting education program, for example, or to provide more hands-on advocacy for families. We were able to reduce the caseloads of the general preventive programs so that instead of working with 15 families, a case planner would be working with 12 families. And then we recognized that we actually needed more capacity in the system. So this year we're launching 1,000 new preventive service slots, which means that we can serve 1,000 more families.
So there was a whole group of workers restructured from office to field, correct?
I think what you're talking about is the Improved Outcomes for Children initiative, which is an effort to really shift the way that we oversee the both the preventive services programs and the foster care programs. What we're trying to do with that initiative is to increase the engagement of families in decision-making about their lives, and we're doing that through a family team conferencing model that brings families, service providers, advocates for the family, or others who are involved with the family around the table together to make the key decisions about how to ensure that the children are safe and the family is getting the support that they need.
Have the nonprofit organizations been given more responsibility and more funding? I know they're concerned about staffing on the prevention side to keep up with the nice words about the expanded mission.
I would say that from our perspective, we really have both provided more resources and more responsibility. But it's important to say what we're taking away also. We're eliminating a layer of case management that has really been the source of a lot of bureaucratic delays in the system up until now. And it's been a source of frustration because we had a system where the ultimate decision-making responsibility in a preventive services case sat with somebody who in the vast majority of cases had never met the family and was not involved in the day-to-day work with the family. And we made a decision that that responsibility really did belong with the preventive service programs, and that they were in a better position to really work with the family face-to-face and figure out what that family needs in order to be able to keep their kids at home safely.
So with these changes, since the death of Nixmary Brown, what do you look for on the preventive side as an indication of success? Because I've read that there's no statistical indication yet that these changes are having an impact.
It's really too soon. We just launched Improved Outcomes for Children in a first phase this summer, and so it will be a while before we can step back and evaluate how it's going. We also are starting with a small group of just 5 providers in Brooklyn so that we can make sure that we work out the kinks and that we can make the new approach work well before we take it to the rest of the city.
What are the big challenges still to be faced? We heard yesterday on the show, for example, about food bank demand going up due to the housing costs in the city over the last few years. Mm-hmm. Are there more poor families under stress as a result of housing, and that leads to more cases of abuse?
So I think affordable housing is always a huge challenge, really around the country, but especially here in New York City, and it's certainly one of the challenges that our preventive service providers work with families on and try to help them resolve. That's probably one of many different stressors that the families we serve face, and I think lack of adequate resources in other parts of the system does create a challenge for the child welfare system. We can't necessarily compensate for gaps in other areas. We do a lot of advocacy, a lot of service coordination. Our preventive providers are really wonderfully zealous and dedicated advocates for the families that they work with.
There's always a delicate balance between removing enough children from their homes and removing too many children from their homes. Do you think that more children are being removed as a result of the Nixmary Brown case?
So our rate of removal in relationship to the reports that are coming in has really stayed quite steady over the last 18 months, and our focus over that 18-month period has really been to get the right decision made in every single case. So we're not pushing removal, we're not pushing preventive services, we're saying for each and every family we need to make a good assessment and figure out exactly what that family needs. And so we have more families going into preventive services. We've brought the utilization of that system up from 90% to 100%, and we're really proud of that success, that we're saying if we identify a family where abuse or neglect has occurred, we need to make sure that each and every one of those families is receiving services to address their needs.
And you're saying you have 100% success rate with that now?
We have 100% utilization in our preventive services.
Which means what exactly?
We're using all the capacity we have in preventive services. What we've actually been able to do on the child protective side is bring down dramatically the number of cases where we do find some abuse or neglect, but the family doesn't receive services. So we're able to get services to almost every family that that has been found to have some abuse or neglect.
Well, let's hope. Elizabeth Roberts, Deputy Commissioner for Family Support Services at the New York City Administration for Children's Services, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you so much.
And coming up in a minute, we will get a critique of how some of those changes are working. Stay with us. WNYC, and our latest crowdsourcing or group journalism project is underway. It's called Hillary, Rudy, Money. We're inviting you to dig into the latest financial statements of our two local presidential candidates and see what you find that's of interest to the public. We have links on our webpage to the Federal Election Commission site where you can see the fundraising and spending records of the Clinton and Giuliani campaigns just released last week. Your job is to dig around in those records for anything that's interesting, unusual, or funny. Then post what you find to our comments page for everyone to see. There's some good stuff there already. Again, just dig around in the Clinton and Julie financial statements for anything that's interesting, unusual, or funny from our local presidential candidates. Then post what you find to our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show for our latest crowdsourcing or group journalism project. And we'll do a segment on this in a few days and put together what you found with what some of the working journalists out there have come up with and see what it all adds up to. All right. So we continue our look now at how New York City works to prevent child abuse in this year and a half now, or almost 2 years after the death of Nick's Mary Brown. And a big part of this is the nonprofit social service agencies that the city contracts with. So we're joined by two members of that community now. Lisa Caswell is the Preventive Services Program Director for the Daycare Council of New York in Parkside, Brooklyn, and Tracy Carter is a parent organizer with the Child Welfare Organizing Project in the Highbridge section of the Bronx. Also with us, Andrew White, the director of the Center for New York City Affairs at the Milano New School for Management and Urban Policy. He edits the journal Child Welfare Watch. So, Andrew, welcome back, and welcome to WNYC, Lisa Caswell and Tracy Carter. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Tracy, let me start with you. Tell us what role you play on the prevention side of the picture. Just tell us about your work.
Well, my job is as a parent organizer with Child Welfare Organizing Project. It's basically to get the parents support that they need while their children are in care or before their children do happen to get into care. We have support groups in Highbridge where any parent is welcome to come in at a Highbridge Community Life Center in the Bronx. We go to court with the parents. We're basically there for support, just to see that the parents understand their rights, that they know what's going on, and that everything, the services that is required of them is being followed through, not only through ACS, but through the foster care agency as well.
So you're both trying to help the parents not abuse their children and help the parents not lose their children
exactly.
In the court system.
Yes, through the court system.
Lisa Caswell, what about your work?
It's not unrelated at all. It's the same mission of keeping families together. It's the largest part of the system now, thanks to readjustments and lowering of numbers of kids in foster care. But our mission is to provide the case management services to families who have been reported for abuse and neglect, but whose kids do not need to be removed, as well as taking care of families from the local neighborhoods who come to us voluntarily to get help to strengthen their family systems and keep their kids with them.
So with respect to that, what do you find has actually changed since the death of Nick's Mary Brown and the outcry in early last year?
Yeah, what used to be the main success components of preventive was that a third of our time was spent writing and documenting, which is sort of a necessity for child welfare. One third of our time was working with the families directly in terms of providing emotional support. And then another third of our time was spent in advocacy. A lot of these families are heavily impacted by the variables you mentioned earlier, the affordable housing issues, the lack of living wage jobs, the whole child care piece, everything that, you know, the deterioration of the public education system. And to the degree that the recent developments in terms of documentation have cut into that amount of time for treatment and advocacy, we're really struggling right now. We're now spending about 50% of our time writing, where we should be working directly with the families and should be advocating for their basic benefits. And in conjunction with that, the staff are becoming demoralized by this shift in their responsibilities. They've trained, they've made a commitment, they oftentimes have decided to go in and serve the lowest level of the people who get the least help from the system, and they've made tremendous sacrifices, and right now they're underpaid. They're not being able to concentrate on what it is that they came into the field to do, and the turnover rates consequently are really beginning to affect us, and the cases are increasing in their risk levels. So we need even more time to empower and to stabilize and to treat families, and we have less of it.
So are you saying that what Deputy Commissioner Roberts was portraying as a good thing, getting more workers out from desks and into the field working with families, comes back on another level as a bad thing because others have to pick up the paperwork and things like that?
Well, what's happening is the system is trying to shift its focus to a really collaborative process, and they're doing it with joint visits between protective workers and preventive workers. They're doing it with elevated risk conferences. They've now shifted this whole monitoring process away from paper to a conferencing model. But they're not paying adequate amount of attention to the real experience of workers in the field on a daily basis. They continue to think about this process on a theoretical basis without following the experience mm-hmm. of the workers who you have to empower if you want to have the families get what they need. So to the degree that these new initiatives add more burden to a worker's tasks and take them away from those two primary pieces, meeting with family members and advocating for their benefits, you're not going to have the successes you're trying to achieve.
Tracy Carter, what are you seeing as the major changes since last year when this all broke?
I see some changes in the ACS system. They all listen to the voices of the parents. The parents are coming out and voicing their concerns about the welfare of children. Tragedy is going to happen, unfortunately. But being that my organization, some of the members that I work with sit on the board with Commissioner Mattingly. So they get to speak with him direct. I think it's like maybe once every 3 months to voice the concerns that they hear from the parents to see how they can change.
That's the Children's Services Commissioner, John Mattingly.
John Mattingly.
Not
yeah.
Don Mattingly,
John,
who's
I'm
up
sorry.
For a different job. You didn't say that.
Okay. But it's a progress. You know, it's not going to happen overnight. It's parents, I mean, we really are trying to look out for the welfare of all children throughout of New York City. We want them all safe, as well as my children. I want them safe.
Do you think things are better or worse or no different in terms of what the city government is doing since Nick's Mary Brown?
I see a little difference. A little. Not much. We're getting there. It's, you know, it's slow. We're not 100% where we should be as far as the welfare of children, but we are getting there. I'm not going to say we're not there all the way, but we're getting there. It's a process.
Andrew White, you edit Child Welfare Watch. What are you watching?
A lot of layers of a lot of different things, and I think one important point is that, you know, this question of moving workers out from behind desks out into the field, that's talking about ACS workers in one particular part of the Administration for Children's Services. And I think some of the controversy there is really this is just changing the nature of their jobs. But it does tie in to what Lisa was talking about in terms of the number of meetings and the number of tasks that are on the plate of the nonprofit agencies is definitely up. Part of the reason for that is because the city is relying far more heavily on the preventive agencies than they ever did before. You know, more than two-thirds, something like 70% of the cases that the preventive family support agencies get are now referred to them by Child Protective Services, which didn't used to be the case. I mean, it was less than half just 2 years ago. So that means they have more of these intense cases, potentially intense cases.
Therefore, like Lisa was saying, more overworked, more stressed?
Yeah, but also, in my opinion, doing what they really need to be doing, particularly given the crisis that unfolded here. You know, it's not as if there was a sea change in the number of abuse and neglect real cases in the city. What happened was public attention came to the issue, and schools' attention came to the issue like never before, and the city was flooded with reports and completely overwhelmed. So, for example, when you ask Tracy, are things better now than they were before? If you look at where they were a year and a half ago, yeah, things are definitely better because we were in pretty dire straits for a little while there after Nick's Mary Brown, largely because of the number of reports that came just flooding into the system.
We can take a few phone calls from some of you listening right now, too, whether you've been in this situation as a parent or a social worker or a family court judge or anyone else who has contact with children in these situations on the changes in city government since the Nick's Mary Brown death at the beginning of last year. And for my guests, Lisa Caswell, Preventive Services Program Director at the Daycare Council of New York in Parkside, Brooklyn, Tracy Carter, a parent organizer with the Child Welfare Organizing Project in Highbridge, the Bronx, and Andrew White, director of the Center for New York City Affairs at the Milano New School for Management and Urban Policy, who edits the Child Welfare Watch Journal. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Peter in Riverdale, you're on WNYC. Hello, Peter.
Hi. I'm a psychologist who's worked for over 20 years in foster care, and I must say I've seen a big improvement since the Mattingly regime replaced not Tory, but whoever it was before.
William Bell.
William Bell, that's right.
Who remembers William Bell?
I just wanted to make a couple of comments about the issue of the removal of children. I do think the preventative approach is much, much wiser, although, as your guests have pointed out, it's very difficult, especially when you don't pay people enough and we don't invest in things for the poor in the city or in the country. But just to go back to the old argument was between family preservation and removal, and preservation includes prevention. But I think in terms of the removal of children, the danger is then you have situations like Nick's Mary Brown is then you start pulling kids left and right for fear that something else is going to happen and ignore the fact that kids die in foster care at a fairly high clip. But just to mention once, there was a recent study by a Jonathan Doyle, professor at MIT, who studied children in Illinois. They discounted the severe abuse and neglect, but those that could go either way, be taken out, be kept in, they have an excellent database in Illinois, and they followed through on it, and they found that over a number of years, those children in, for instance, I think it was 14% of the children who remained in their home had arrest records. 44% of those taken into foster
right.
care.
So you're saying, yeah, records. People look at the pros and cons of leaving somebody in the home without taking into account what the actual alternative really is,
right.
Which is the risk of being in a foster home.
Yeah,
Andrew?
I think he's got a very good point that you know, foster care is no panacea, and that's one of the reasons the systems have changed over the years. You know, back when we had the Elisa Izquierdo case in the mid-1990s, the quick result to that was a 50% increase in the number of removals, and that meant every year we were taking New York City was taking about 12,000 kids out of their home, and the results were not all that great.
What's the number now?
The number now is back up to about 7,500 in 2006 when it was down below 5,000 mm-hmm. the year before. But, you know, another really important point to make is that, you know, the general public thinks of this system about as though it is really about protecting kids from getting killed and or even brutalized. And in fact, that is one piece of the system, but it is such a rare circumstance in the broad scheme. You heard Liz Roberts describe the number of kids that the system comes into contact with every year. I've calculated it's something like 7 out of every 100 kids in New York City comes into contact with the child welfare system this year, will come into contact with it this year. And that, you know, those families are not dealing with, most of them anyway, are not dealing with severe physical abuse. Most of them are dealing with a whole other set of issues.
Primarily?
Housing problems, poverty, human frailty, you know, mental illness, domestic violence, et cetera, et cetera.
Tracy Carter, you've been part of this system on both sides.
Yes,
having had your children removed from your home by ACS, but you were able to get them back.
Yes.
And now you work with parents. How are things different now from when you lost your kids and fought to get them back?
It's much different. I mean, when I lost my, that was back in 2000. Basically, I did everything on my own. I went into my own drug program. I stayed on top of things as far as the welfare. It took me almost a month and a half before I even knew where my children was. I lived in the Bronx. My children was placed in Brooklyn. That's three trains from where I lived in the Bronx to visit my children. I did my best. I tried to make every visit. Today is more, you do have the workers that's actually willing to help. You know, you have the ACS visiting coach teams that will come in and step in and monitor the visits if for the families if the workers cannot do it. So I see a big change. I refer a lot of parents to the visiting coach therapeutic with ACS. So I see that happening a lot, and it seems to be helping the families where they're not stagnated into being inside of a little cubicle inside the agency. They get to come out, and it's like a more of a bonding with them and trying to reunify with the children. So I see a change.
Sounds
from
like
I
real improvement.
It. Yes.
Steve in Hempstead, you're on WNYC. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how you doing?
All right.
I just had two thoughts. The first one is an easy one about the whole money issue. You want to have workers stay in the field, you got to be willing to invest. And that we are losing people the way we are is indicative of society's commitment to really doing this and doing it well. The other one is, as a social worker in one of the city's psych emergency rooms, I find myself oftentimes encouraging the parents to call ACS, rather than seeing ACS as an adversary, seeing it as somebody who you can reach out to and say, I don't know what to do with my kid anymore. And I know the school is going to call you, or I know the social worker is going to call you. But I'm calling you too, and I'm begging for help. And then I tell them, you just got to keep leaning on the service so that you get out of this adversary role, and the ACS gets to see you as a parent who's saying, I want to keep my kids, but I need your help desperately.
And you've gotten to that point. So between your testimonial and Tracy's, those are some indications that ACS is really more productively involved with families' lives than it was once upon a time.
I hope so. I mean, a lot of times in an emergency room, you don't hear from the families afterwards. I just lean on the parents and keep pitching. You know, these people will help you if you call them.
Steve, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. But Lisa Caswell, you were sounding more of a cautionary note before.
Yeah, I think that the system is actually at a very frightening place right now, given the fact that all of the efforts to help facilitate collaboration, which were built into the documentation system, the connection system, all of the efforts they've made to have these joint visits, these elevated risk conferences, each component in the system, the protective, the preventive, the foster care, are all heavily overburdened at this point. And in the process of trying to facilitate a wraparound process, if you don't give these workers time to actually focus on the clients and actually support them in the process, you're not going to have the outcomes that we're looking for. Right now, just for an example, in the documentation system for us, we have three separate systems we're working with, and none of them are linked. One of them is the most critical, the advocates' templates, which really preserve the privacy of those cases that are not indicated. But for the indicated cases, the city system, the promise system, the connection system, none of them are linked. So the workers are spending endless amount of time doing double data entry. On top of that, what's happening now with the higher risk cases, by virtue of the fact that right now 50% of New York City kids are dropping out, 40% of black men are unemployed. What we know is that if you don't help people in terms of stabilizing their lives financially and give them the basic supports anyone needs, you can't ask them to deal with their deeper emotional issues.
Andrew, is some of that structural stuff changing since Nick's Mary Brown?
Yeah, I mean, I think the
in terms of the paperwork,
sure, the burden of the paperwork is heavier than ever on preventive agencies, and there is talk at the state level of making some pretty radical transformations of that, which could be positive, but I don't know where that's going yet. The other point that Lisa makes about the schools and dropout is actually more directly linked to this than you might think, because ACS has basically become the city's default truancy system. You know, when a kid doesn't show up at school, now ACS gets called if they don't show up for several days. And that has placed a huge burden on the front line.
We've just got about 2 minutes more to talk about the changes in child welfare in New York City since the death of Nick's Mary Brown at the beginning of last year. And then we're going to take on the road rage incident on the FDR Drive and the cultures behind off-duty cop meeting cruising kids. But Yvonne in Manhattan, you'll be our last caller on child welfare today. Hi, Yvonne. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Okay.
Listen, I just wanted to encourage other funders. I'm from the Daphne Foundation in New York, and we are a supporter, actually, of CWOP. And just want to encourage other funders, whether they're a foundation, corporation, or individual, to really support organizations like CWOP. A lot of foundations and individuals are afraid to fund advocacy, but the work that they're doing is really key to the relationship building. You know, the CWOP parent organizer mentioned earlier that they meet with Commissioner Mattingly, and these relationships take advocacy money. That's what advocacy is, and sometimes people confuse that with lobbying.
And just so people are clear, CWOP is Tracy's organization,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, Tracy, Child Welfare Organizing Project.
Right. So it's it sounds like it's advocacy on behalf of the parents so they don't lose their kids, but also support and services for those parents so they can do the best they can in their homes.
Exactly, because the gentleman mentioned earlier, removal should be the very, very last thing. And the preventive services, the parent organizing, education, those are the things that really need to take place because you can prevent the removals.
Thank you very much. I'm sure Tracy appreciates the shout-out
yes,
to funders.
I would say that, you know, what she's talking about with CWOP is actually emblematic of some of the most interesting, best things happening in child welfare here today, which is like the case conferencing that Liz Roberts spoke about earlier. We can actually get help to families.
Whoops, did you just knock off your microphone?
I think I got it.
There you go.
Sorry about that. They can actually organize help for families and get families engaged in ways that they never did before, and that's in large part because of the work of groups like CWOP.
Well, Tracy Carter, a parent organizer with CWOP, the Child Welfare Organizing Project, in the hybrid section of the Bronx. Lisa Caswell, Preventive Services Program Director at the Daycare Council of New York in Parkside, Brooklyn. And Andrew White from the Milano New School and editor of the journal Child Welfare Watch. Thank you all very much for coming back on and talking about this important topic.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up, behind the death of the young man on the FDR drive in an altercation with an off-duty police officer. Stay with us.